Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo. With me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy last podcast before the Syracuse preview week.
Yeah, get yourselves prepped, because it's going to be likely an hour and 20 of talking every aspect of Syracuse from most of the players on the roster. We'll probably take some unexpected twists and turns. Who knows where else? I'm excited. It's also the clearest sign yet that the season is almost upon us.
Yes. Hopefully it'll publish and you can hear this week and we won't have to like figure something stupid out.
Last week worked, so I'm gonna have faith.
Last week did work. So moving on and moving up, I guess.
Agreed. We're going to get into our Atlantic Division sans Syracuse preview for the second half of this week's episode, but in the first half, going to talk just a little bit about, you know, some of the things happening with Syracuse, some of the things we've been doing on the site, just have some more spirited conversations about those items. First and foremost, a little bit of a foray into our second favorite topic on this show, beer, and how ACC football programs rank with regard to what's available locally. As always, one fan base is pissed off. Last year it was BC. The year before it was Georgia Tech. This year it is Virginia. Virginia is the most annoyed with me of all the fan bases. I rank them 9th out of 14. Dan, yes, I haven't been to Charlottesville. But no, I don't necessarily think that, given who's listed in front of them, that there's really much of a leg to stand on.
Yeah, I mean, it's that, and also, like, this is a pretty good conference in terms of, especially when you expanded the strictness of, or I guess lessened the strictness of the locations. Like, there are a lot of really good beer areas in the conference, so, like, being 9th is not, like Syracuse is really, really good beer, and finishing 10th is, like, not that big a deal, because, like, the top 12 all have really, really good scenes, based compared to, like, probably a lot of the other...
Most of the SEC, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the SEC, I feel like there are a couple like notable places here and there, and like obviously Pac-12, you have all the California spots, and like there, but Big Ten, you know, Midwest has some decent stuff, but the ECC like really covers a lot of ground. So no real, like, I don't know, I wouldn't get too upset about being anywhere on this list, to be honest.
No, absolutely not. And like, to me, I think there was a clear like top 7 or 8, and then there was everybody else. I mean, I've definitely seen more complaints. All time, I've seen more complaints about non-Syracuse placements than I've ever seen about Syracuse's ranking on a list. This particular list, which I've been doing for 3 or 4 years. Very puzzling. Number one change this year because of the change in criteria that you mentioned. The new number one is BC. I gave them, unlike previous years, the entire Boston area, not just the Chestnut Hill, Newton area that they were limited to beforehand. So that gave them access to Trillium, Lamplighter, Night Shift, numerous other breweries. You could go far past the top three that I, listed there. NC State was 2, Georgia Tech 3, Duke was 4, and rounding out the top 5 was Louisville, largely on the strength of Against the Grain as the top brewery for them, and I'd say one of the best breweries in the conference. Dan, just kind of sampling the list here, do you feel like there's one city in particular that you really want to get more familiar with in terms of their local beer scene?
North Carolina, it's not a blind spot for me. I've had a lot of stuff from North Carolina overall, not UNC specifically, but like... Actually, I'd say more of the Triangle area, because I've been to Winston-Salem a bunch, so I know Foothills really well. I know a couple of the other breweries there really well, and they were the number one before we expanded the search here. But I'd definitely like to know more, like get more stuff from like the Raleigh area, because almost everything I've had from North Carolina overall is very good. I know Asheville isn't represented here, but obviously they're one of the more noteworthy like small cities in terms of beer production in the country. So overall, like outside of the Charlotte and Greensboro, Winston-Salem like trio of spots, I'd definitely like to try more stuff from like Eastern North Carolina.
Fair. I know you mentioned Asheville. one of a friend of the show and friend of the blog, Woody Whitehurst, one of the only sufferable Clemson fans on the internet, was trying to claim Asheville area for Clemson.
That's a little bro.
I know. It was more of a joke, of course. He started with Asheville and then started grabbing at Athens, Brevard, numerous other places. I kind of laughed it off. Lauren Brownlow got into a spirited debate with him.
Yeah, I think state boundaries are something to respect here.
Yes.
Even if Clemson is pretty close to like both parts of both those states.
Yeah, and that's totally fine. I think in general, like, South Carolina, to be honest, has come a long way in recent years. I think that they'll continue to progress. Virginia Tech, on the other hand, and our friend Beer Control definitely takes this all in stride. But Virginia Tech, once again, last in this list. I don't necessarily see how they get out of that unless Blacksburg suddenly becomes a hub for quality craft beer. And, I mean, it's happened before in some cases. Like, I remember when I first started doing things like this, and Tallahassee really didn't have much option to choose from. And now, you know, Tallahassee actually finished, you know, just below us, and they're seemingly getting better by the day. But, you know, places like Virginia Tech, the area around Notre Dame, plenty of places in the Big 12 and the SEC, which have more stringent alcohol laws. Those spots just seem to not necessarily progress at the same rate. So I do like to see kind of differences year to year. That's in part why I changed the criteria too, because it makes it a little bit more fun to make these lists look slightly different and give people different things to be happy about, different things to complain about. I know last year, number one was actually Wake Forest, just on the strength of Foothills. The year previous, when we just did individual beers, Louisville was number one for Against the Grain's Bowen Luke, which is among my favorite beers.
Yeah, I'm like the Tallahassee and Blacksburg. Like, I think there's always a shot because it's a top, they're college towns, so like stuff pops up around them because of that. So there isn't like, it's not inconceivable that some like really awesome microbrewery pops up in Blacksburg in the next couple of years and makes some like really cool stuff. It just might take a while for the word to get out to like where we're hearing about it or where we obviously have a chance to try it. So yeah, it's not like out of the realm. It's just like it's you know, they're both works in progress, and Clemson too. I mean, it's just a small college town, so like it could happen, but they don't get the chance to like claim like something that's, you know, in a larger town that also happens to be where a college is. Even something like Winston-Salem, where like Wake Forest is obviously a major part of that town, but it's still like a pretty big town outside of Wake Forest being there, so there's just more going on. Clemson doesn't really have that. Va Tech doesn't really have that. Tallahassee obviously is a bigger town, but which is probably the most surprising one in terms of like they're not being this like really solid beer scene, but it's also Florida State, and I imagine they drink a lot of macro brews.
Well, I think in general, Florida just seems like they were pretty behind. I mean, other than Cigar City, and then more recently, like Funky Buddha, you weren't necessarily talking about breweries in Florida getting any sort of real national hype or national press. That's changed of late, with, you know, places like Jay Wakefield that I mentioned, Wynwood, and others. Like, I think Florida's just a little bit behind, but I don't think they're as far behind as much of the, like, you know, true South that they share that part of the country with. So I do think that they'll keep progressing, to be honest. And I think, like, you know, it really just, you were saying, like, these places pop up pretty quickly. It honestly just takes one beer enthusiast graduate decide to put their talents to work and open up a local spot and start making great beers. And, like, that's how scenes grow, and in one spot turns into two turns into four, and suddenly you have a pretty, you know, bustling beer scene. I mean, the whole Research Triangle area wasn't always, you know, one of the darlings and kind of like smaller market gems of the beer scene in America. And in the last, you know, 5 to 7 years, it's really been able to develop quite well.
Yeah, for sure. And hopefully we see more stuff pop up at a lot of these places that we can then go visit.
I would agree. Moving on from beer until we swing back around to it for halftime, I want to chat a couple other things going on right now. In particular, numbers that showed that, yeah, maybe Eric Dungy should run a little bit less. I know this is kind of a running joke for Syracuse fans at this point, that he will run less. We've said it every single year, and every single year it doesn't happen. He actually runs more. But if you look at Bill C's numbers over at Football Study Hall last week, They did look at running backs and running quarterbacks who are both efficient and explosive. Eric Dungy was not among the top 20 or so in terms of balanced players like that. And it's not to say that like that replaces an eye test. And I think, but I, at the same time, I think an eye test does tell you that, you know, for every big home run that, that Dungy gets, he's getting hit for 1 and 2 yard gains just as frequently. So I personally think the offensive line improvements, and something we'll talk about next week, I think those improvements are going to help him here, but it does really boil down to, is he looking to pass first or run first? And if there's quality blocking, hopefully he moves his quick reads, which this this offense kind of calls for, you know, transitions those to be pass first and quick throws near the line of scrimmage versus, you know, taking off and kind of biding his time in the backfield as he has in the last couple seasons.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there. It's just as much about the surrounding cast, specifically the offensive line and the receivers and their ability to get open, as it is for Dungy. Obviously, I think he was a little bit quick. I wouldn't say quick trigger, quick to tuck it when he started to feel some pressure. I'm sure there were definitely spots if you went back and looked where he could have stood in the pocket, stepped up, and made another read. And instead he like runs and scrambles out and takes a hit and probably only gets a couple yards. I don't have a problem when he leaks out if there's really good coverage and he leaks out and is able to make something happen and pick up a first down or pick up 8 yards or something like that. But hopefully we get to a point with the surrounding cast where he can afford to make the extra read, take an extra step up in the pocket, identify some other things in the field that he didn't have time to do the year before. And that only really takes like an extra, you know, half second of time. And hopefully with the offensive line improvements or what we hope are improvements, that'll be, you know, he'll be able to do that and still keep the danger that comes from his running ability, which, you know, is a factor for the defense to consider. So we don't want to like completely strip him of his game or completely strip him of what makes him a unique quarterback in this league, but you don't want him taking off and taking unnecessary hits. And even just like those 1 or 2 yard gains where, you know, I'd rather see him just throw the ball away unless it's third down. And, or even if it's just like a hopeless situation, just, you know, throw it away and live to see another down versus, you know, taking what could be, what, you know, might not even look like a big hit, but we know those things add up, especially for someone who has a history of concussions. So we'll see. Hopefully, you know, all these things allow him to be more effective in that regard.
Yeah, completely. And like, that's not to say that he doesn't throw well on the run. He actually did last year. I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but while it was tracking plays, it was something that I was paying some mind to, is that, you know, when he was rolling out of the pocket, he actually was completing throws well, and it's because he was sucking in defenses to try to prevent him from taking off. So like you said, you don't want to stop him from doing that, but Bill C's numbers remove sacks from the equation, and he still had well over 100 carries last year, and that's in 9 games. To me, that does seem kind of problematic, even with the increased size. I know he's like 6'4", 226 right now. He's going to lose a little bit of that weight throughout the season. I just think, you know, you saw the accuracy go down as the year wore on. You saw him feel the hits, not just in his legs, but in his arms. I think his, in general, you know, taking too long to make those reads, whether it was running or passing, did start to harm him accuracy-wise. So I hope that we start having those quick reads because, and again, something we'll talk about next week, but when you have, you know, speedy options near the line of scrimmage, like Sean Riley, Nakeem Johnson, when you have somebody like Ravion Pierce, who is a guy who can create mismatches, but that there's a limited window for that before, you know, bigger players start coming toward him if he slips in behind the line, like, I do think that we see a resurgence in accuracy from Dungy, more resembling like the 64-65% he had in 2016 versus the 59.7% we saw last year.
Yeah, you don't want to have him play in a way that he's not comfortable doing, and you don't want to try to turn him into something he's not. So I think it just has to come from both sides. Like, you have to put him in a position where he can hang in the pocket more, and that's not going to be an issue, and he's not going to take sacks that way, but also Just cut down on the needless examples of him storting out of the pocket. So hopefully these are both things that are coming. I think we're both pretty optimistic about the offensive line, although it's tough to know until we finally see them. But on paper, it seems like something that should be reasonable to expect. A lot of it also comes down to the receiving core and having guys that can get open even more than just like the 1 or 2 guys we've had the last couple of years.
Oh, yeah. And we've talked about that, too, quite a bit, that this might be a more well-rounded group, and having more options that you trust, or maybe more options you have the same amount of trust for, could help that long-term. For some reason, while you were talking there, I also just had a flashback to that nonsensical, it was like diving front flip that he did in game one last year.
That was great.
Yeah, that was one of the more horrifying things I've seen from him. And that was in a completely meaningless game against Central Connecticut. So I very much hope that we don't see more of that this year at all.
Yeah, especially in a game like that. Hopefully we are well into DeVito time before Dungy decides to start like doing, you know, acrobatics for no reason when we're up multiple touchdowns.
I very much agree. Another side note from the last, you know, few days or week of coverage over on the blog, Kook Center, the SB Nation's Washington State blog, has been doing their annual Never Kick graphic, kind of tracking how much teams go for it on fourth down, how much they avoid punting, how much they avoid kicking. You see a very entertaining graph for Syracuse, you know, from the height of the Schaefer era, really just punting all the time, and then swinging all the way up to now, where we're one of the top 10 teams in the country in terms of going for it. I mentioned in the comments, and you might remember from last year, where I was kind of tracking, like, just how often, like what was, like, the plus-minus kind of that conversation. So looking at a drive and seeing the, if you went for it, seeing what happened for you, the team, but then also seeing what happened on the next drive, whether you made or missed, or, and especially if you missed. Because then, like, did that turnover on downs actually result in the other team putting up points? And I feel like, if I recall correctly, like, SU was something like plus 59 points or something like that. They really only had, I think, one game where going for it actually resulted in points for the other team. Which, to me, I mean, not having anybody else's numbers in front of me and not having the exact figures for SU clouds that, you know, conclusion a little bit. But I feel like for if you run our tempo, and maybe this is the case for everybody else too, like seeing that sort of swing in points gives you every reason that as long as you're probably within, you know, your own 45, it's worth at least giving it a shot as long as you have some reasonable yards to go.
Yeah, I think Dino's done a really nice job of it, and it's very jarring to look at the numbers compared to the Schaefer years especially. But I appreciate it. And it's also helped that the fact that we have a very good punter. So it's not like he has to avoid, like, he has to worry about a punt going wrong because, you know, 95% of the time the punt will be fine. So he really has, like, a very good base from which to make that decision. And I think he's done, you know, a really good job with it so far.
Yeah, and I mean, you and I were saying this during the Schaefer era, too. Like, I'd rather you went for it on fourth seven times and only converted two of them than punted things away in fourth and short situations as often as we did there. Just kind of give up on drives, especially when points are at a premium. Like for Babers, theoretically, points shouldn't really be at a premium. They are in some cases, if only because of the quality of the defenses in the ACC, the fact that we haven't been overly efficient. But at the same time, yeah, like I'd much rather maximize our opportunities and try to do everything we can to get points. And you know, if the defense is holding up as it was for much of last year, save the last like three or four games, like I'm fine putting it on the defense to make a stop in spurts and not pulling, you know, what happened during the Schaefer era, which was always put it on the defense to make a stop and never trust your offense to put points on the board, which is the only way you're going to win games.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the most important thing is just to do it within the flow of the game. You know how your offense is playing. You know how the matchups are. You know how your defense is playing. So, like, it's easier just to say, you know, plug in the New York Times fourth down bot and say, like, every single time it says to go for it, you should go for it. I tend to be more inclined with, you know, a lot of those decisions. But overall, like, you have to have a feel for how things are going and just, like, make those decisions based on what you like on the field versus just, like, being crazy about it or not going for it. But it felt like so often, you know, Schaefer just didn't feel like I mean, he says it was confidence in the defense, but so often it was just so little confidence in the offense, even in situations in which they had the major advantage in terms of down and distance or personnel or even just, like, a drive had gone pretty well.
General momentum.
Yeah, just, like, and I know there's, like, debates over whether momentum exists or whatnot, but, like, I feel like you just have to know sometimes, like, what it is very feel-based, and we know that's a big part of how Babers coaches. He doesn't, you know, look at his playbook during games, and he just kind of, you know, rolls out there with you know, and has a decent, like, idea of what he wants to see on a play-to-play basis. I do wonder if that number is going to flatten out a bit this year if the defense improves, as we hope. I think a lot of it was he was playing to the strengths of the team, which last year was definitively the offense, especially late in the year, even when things started to, you know, the team started to bang up, and but the defense, you know, really struggled down the stretch. So I hopefully, I don't know if I hope that the number goes down, but I do wonder, you know, what the what Babers numbers look like with a better defense. Looking at Bowling Green, he was at he went for on fourth down 17.16% of the time. His first year in 2014, which was number 75 in the country, they really went had fourth downs. They had 134, which ranked really low. They kicked field goals a lot, so I think a lot of drives stalled out in you know relatively decent field position. And then all in 2015, his last year there, they jumped all the way up to 30.3%, which they was ranked pretty close to the top of the country. What were we in last year? Last year we were
very high.
We were top 8, I think, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think this year he was like 11. So, yeah, it seemed, you know, kind of similar to what we've seen in the 2 years. Obviously, Bowling Green was lower his first year there. They were also, you know, they were a better team that year than Syracuse was, at least relative to the competition. But a similar jump from year to year, so it could also be like, you know, him getting comfortable with his roster type deal. So maybe we'll actually see him. I don't know how much higher we're going to get than what we did last year based on, like, you know, being ranked that high in the country, but maybe that could be just more normal than what we've seen previously.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like, remember, too, like, this is without a real short yardage option as well. So I'll definitely take it, and again, I hope it does improve. Because I think that this team staying that aggressive is can only be seen as a good thing. And the more points that we put on the board, no matter how much this defense manages to improve this year, again, can only be a positive for us, because I think we really need to get toward, you know, that closer to that 30 points per game is a reasonable bar this year, just because we've kind of fallen short of that, especially late in seasons these past couple of years. So open for more points, and more points means likely more fourth down conversions, too.
That'd be nice.
All right. I know it's a little early, but why don't we move on to some halftime, and then we can jump into the Atlantic.
Let's do it. Forgot to put my on tap on the right page. But I had a pretty good weekend. I spent some of it upstate. I spent some of it in Vermont. So both, obviously, pretty good places for beer. So at first, I was up in the Albany area. I visited my friend at Wolf Hollow, where I bring up their beer a lot. They had a cast. They conditioned their amber with some tiramisu flavor.
Interesting.
Made for a really delicious, you know, taste. Pretty interesting because it was, you know, it definitely still drank like their amber, which is nice and crisp and like pretty balanced. The tiramisu wasn't like crazy overpowering. Definitely had some coffee notes, but not like super dark like a lot of coffee beers. It was also colder, sort of colder than your normal cast. Which I appreciated. I don't always love how cast beer drinks. I don't order it as much because of that. That's a very American thing of me. I'm sure I would get raked over coals in England for that.
Probably.
So that was delicious. I also had their night lager, which was very good. And then up in Burlington, outside Burlington, I had a rarefied air from Fiddlehead Brewing, which was delicious. I had a tribute from 14th Star. A couple different things from 14th Star. Also, their Valor Ale. I think they're run by a number of veterans, so their beers are all named for, you know, various veteran-specific words and phrases. And I think they donate to various funds. But their beers were all very good. The Valor, I think, was probably my favorite. That was their Red Ale. What else did I have up there? I had a You Can't Get There From Here, the Black Raspberry and Currants edition by Burlington Beer Company, which was delicious. That was a sour, but they do a lot of different flavors of that, so that was really good. I had an Athenaeum from Hermit Thrush, which was, I think, brewed for the bar up there, the Archives, which is similar to, like, a Barcade, which, for some reason, all of those, like, seem to get their own local beers, so that was really good. I had a Susan from Hill Farmstead. Always everything from Hill Farmstead, always great. I went to Foam Brewers for a bit. I only had one beer there. We're just stopping in. I know that's supposed to be like the new trendy spot in Burlington. I had their Distro Lemonade, which was really interesting. It is a it's listed as a sour, but there's also a lot of like has a lot of different like wheat notes. So it kind of drinks like a really lemony Belgian, but a little drier. That was really good. I had a Jaguar Shark from Zero Gravity, which was delicious. I had a Wilson's Clover from Zero Gravity, which was delicious. So a lot of really good stuff. Burlington's an awesome beer town. So, yeah, that was a really good, solid weekend for me.
Nice. Busy weekend for you. On my end, nothing like crazy. Was down at Ballast Point again in Long Beach. My parents were in town, so I went to take them over there. Had a Grunion Pale Ale and also had a Spruce Tip IPA that was only on draft there. Grabbed a 4-pack of Beechwood Amalgamator, one of my favorite IPAs that I talk about on here a lot. Was down in Orange County for a bit and had from a Rip Brewing Company, a beer company down in San Diego, the Tragically Rip. It's a pale ale from them. Also had a Smog City Coffee Porter and opened up a bottle of Celador Ale's Entropic. It's a wild ale with passion fruit, guava, and tangerines primarily. So really good beer there. In general, I said, had a good amount of beers, but kept it kind of moderately interesting. Not as extravagant as your weekend, Dan.
I regret nothing. I was also in a new city, so I you know, had to explore the local scene, especially one like Burlington, which has a million breweries.
Of course.
Yeah, I'm not sure if we'll do this up in time, but should mention it just in case we do. Tomorrow, Thursday the 16th, brought up a couple times, I will be at Broken Bow Brewing in Tuckahoe, New York, talking Syracuse football and drinking beers and talking beers, probably not drinking Syracuse football, as part of the Westchester and Fairfield County Alumni Association. They have an event there every year, so hopefully we get a decent turnout. Get a chance to hang out for a couple hours. I am looking forward to trying their beers. I know they're very local, so that's always a treat. And if you're in the city or just north of the city, shouldn't be too hard to get there. It's right off the Crestwood stop on the Harlem line from Metro North. So hope to see some of you guys there. And again, not sure if we'll get this episode up in time, but if it were a little late, then hopefully I saw some of you there and we had a good time.
Ask Tulane questions.
Yes, for me, as I was reminded, I said I would buy beers for anyone who brought Tulane merch. So I assume everyone's going to be putting me out of. I'm sure I won't be able to pay rent this month because of all the Tulane hats that I get.
We can only hope. All right, so the Atlantic Division. Now we're still not happy we're in this division, if only because it's difficult. But whatever, still interesting. The teams bore us at this point because we have to play them so often. But let's just start at the top in terms of alphabetical order. Boston College. This podcast is probably going to have a lot more shade than the previous one. We had a couple teams that we were kind of aiming at that time. Here, I feel like there's a lot of things to say about the teams that everyone's deemed darlings at this point. And that starts with BC, who a lot of notable media members are kind of ranking in their top 25. Phil Steele had them among his top 25 teams. So Brett McMurphy submitted his ballot, and his had BC, I think, at 21 or 22. So this is potentially looking like a top 25 Eagles team. Dan, A, do you believe it? And if you don't, give me your reasons why you don't.
I don't believe it. I can see where they do become a top 25 team. They need a lot to go right for them. A.J. Dillon's being crowned as, like, the next really prolific Boston College running back, and he very well may be, but it's going to be very difficult if they don't have a passing attack to keep defenses honest. And last year, Anthony Brown had some moments, including some moments in some pretty good teams. He was also dreadful in some games and in some pretty bad teams. Louisville was one of them. Louisville had the worst defense in the ACC, including us, and he just could not figure them out. Yet, you know, he played well in some other teams. So if he comes along and takes a big sophomore year step forward, then they can be pretty dangerous. They do have to replace a bunch, especially on defense, from a pretty good team last year. So I can see it. If Brown comes along and they have a legitimate multifaceted offense and it's not just Dillon running into the line for, you know, 4 yards a carry, then yeah, they could be pretty good, but even those, like, pretty good Boston College teams of recent vintage are, like, top out at, like, seven, you know, 8 wins. So it's not, like, a huge... I just don't think the ceiling is super high. So, you know, maybe that's good enough to sneak into the back end of the top 25. But I think that's probably, like, best-case scenario.
Yeah, I mean, BC under Addazio, for the last 5 years, they've won no more than 7 games. They won 7-7, 3-7, and 7. So, yeah, they've had talent at the NFL level, and yeah, they pulled off some nice upsets, but they haven't necessarily seen the payoff with the, you know, NFL caliber talent they've been able to churn out. You know, they pretty much bring back everybody on offense, save wide receivers, but I don't really think that matters. I think that the leading receiver is probably going to be tight end Tommy Sweeney, who's a all-conference contender and potentially more. They do replace a hell of a lot on defense, and I think that's something everyone keeps just writing off. Like, Zach Allen's back, Lucas Dennis is back, and those are two guys who are definitely going to get a ton of hype in conference and elsewhere. But, like, you don't just replace guys like Harold Landry and Ty Schwab. It's not like BC's recruiting at a top 30 level and can just reload there. I think that there is going to be a little bit of a step back on the defensive side of the ball, if only because they have to replace those bodies. And, like, you know, Dillon was really a workhorse at the end of last year, and I think that's being completely discounted for some reason. Like, we've seen this before with BC running backs. I think he had, like, well over 200 carries, and he really only started, you know, being their primary back and a guy who was carrying 20, 25 times a game, like, over the last 8 games of the season. So, like, his numbers are impressive, and I'm not taking that away from him at all, but I do wonder what durability looks like for any back, not just him. If you're put through the ringer like that, even behind what might be the ACC's top offensive line.
Yeah, Dillon, he was getting a pretty good workload. I mean, he only ran 5 times in the season opening win against Northern Illinois. He ran it, you know, in the teens the next 3 games. Vautech, he was held to 10 carries, and then from there he carried 39, 24, 33, 36, 24, 23, 32. So it picked up in Central Michigan and then really picked up after the Vautech game, and that's where they started winning games, really. They were 5-2 in that stretch from at Louisville on. The only loss coming to NC State, where he ran for 196 yards, and Iowa in the bowl game, where he ran for 157. His lowest output that stretch was 89 in Virginia, which weirdly was the team to really bottle him up. Vautech smacked them last year, Virginia smacked them last year in a pretty bizarre 41-10 game, given the fact that I think Virginia was already definitely on their downswing, right? By that point last season?
I believe so, yeah.
It was October 21st. Let me find their schedule from last year.
That one, Virginia won.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Oh, yeah.
Or that's what
oh, no, sorry, not say. Virginia won. BC won. Yeah, BC won despite the fact that...
I'm an idiot.
All good.
Yes, you should probably just cut that. BC won despite the fact that Virginia... all right. Boston College won despite the fact that Virginia bottled up A.J. Dillon for only 89 yards on 24 carries, no touchdowns, a week after he scored 4 times in Louisville. Yeah, I was just looking at W's and L's backwards for
That's
a second
right.
there. Not great. Yeah, so of all teams, you wouldn't expect Virginia to be the one to do that, but obviously it didn't really matter based on the score. Yeah, so if he gets those kind of carry numbers, obviously Andre Williams is the guy that everyone's thinking of. We saw Andre Williams go down in our game against him in 2014, or 2013 rather. Stott Shaver's first year as head coach, and we went, you know, had to win that game to go to the Texas Bowl. Andre Williams went down pretty early in the game, I believe. And not that you know, meant that Syracuse was going to, you know, lose. They were handling him really well that game. But it's like the risk you run when you're going to have your running back carry, like, the ball 30 times on average. He's getting hit a lot, and, you know, it just takes one to knock him out for a game or knock him out for weeks at a time. So he's really, really good. It's actually amazing. He did not catch one pass last year.
That is weird. Also not weird because it's BC, and no matter who is a quarterback, I mean, Brown had a couple of good games, but by and large, like, there's not really anyone to throw to besides Sweeney, and any backup is not really going to be able to do much. So...
Which is interesting. They can't, like, there wasn't, like, one situation in which he was, like, an outlet that Brown could dump off to.
Right.
He was, I haven't seen how their passing game was developed. I don't think it was very much, considering Brown, even when he, you know, really took over, threw for 200 yards twice.
Which is still, like, more than they... I think Brown had more 200-yard games than they had in, like, the three previous seasons or something like that. I feel like I ran the numbers on it, and it was, like, embarrassing.
He averaged 5.3 yards an attempt, which is pretty pedestrian. Only 9 interceptions through, like, 9 games. Not great. He had a positive touchdown interception rate, which is decent for what you'd say. He only got sacked 7 times, which is good. So they prevented, like, big losses. He also really only started using his legs about midway through his when he was really the main starter here in that Vatek game in week 6, I believe. Their 6th game, he ran 50 yards, and after that he was more of a threat on the ground. But overall, that hasn't been as much of a factor as you'd imagine, just he's a pretty mobile quarterback. So yeah, there were some things to like here. The 275-yard game against UVA is basically why they can afford to have Dylan kind of shut down in that one. He threw for 3 touchdowns, completed almost 80% of his passes, so that's great. If he has more of those, then this offense might really hum. It's the fact that he was pretty pedestrian otherwise. Probably below pedestrian, to be honest. So if they're getting more of the 130 no touchdown, 1 interception, sub 50% completion games, it's going to be a struggle. Now, that was Clemson, so not every defense is going to look like Clemson, but Clemson wasn't the only defense that did that to him last year. Louisville also did. So, yeah, it really depends on what kind of step forward Brown takes and if he can find some consistency. If he does, then I think we could see some upside, take a look at their schedule to see, what they could possibly do here.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the schedule now. I've got Sherwin's against UMass and Holy Cross. I got a win against Temple. I think they beat us. And the rest of it's kind of weird because, winnable games against Wake and Purdue are both on the road. NC State, same deal.
The road slate's just very unforgiving. At Wake is I think those teams are pretty close. Purdue, same thing. I think Purdue, those are both pretty close teams. NC State, right in the mix there. And then Vatek of Florida State at the end of the season, they'll be pretty definitive underdogs.
I mean, that's a hellish stretch from October 13th through November 17th. You got Louisville, Miami, at Vatek, Clemson, and at Florida State. Your entire bowl hopes could just be dashed if you go 1-4 in that stretch.
Yeah, I think the Wake-Purdue games are they're over the course of 9 days, it looks like. I assume one of those is a Friday?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think getting one of those is pretty huge for the bowl hopes because, there's no guarantee that Louisville will talk about it obviously in a bit. It's hard to know what they'll be without Lamar Jackson, but they have a lot of talent. They have more talent than BC on the roster overall. So you can't just assume a win there. Obviously, Miami should be very good. Clemson is going to probably run the table. Vatek, winning at Vatek is very difficult no matter what. Same winning at Florida State, especially once they're probably playing some of their best football at the end of the season. BC could be pretty good and only finish 6-6 or 7-5 based on the schedule just because the road home splits are not friendly at all.
Yeah, and that's the weird thing. Nobody's really looking at that schedule when they're projecting top 25 and nonsense like that. BC is going to be a good team this year. That good team still might struggle to win more than 6 games, and that's fine. And what I have a problem with is people just blindly buying in as top 25 team. Good luck finding more than 7 wins on that schedule. If it happens, hey, I was wrong, not the first time. But I want to move a little bit more swiftly on the other teams. I know that was an extended BC chat because we had some shade to throw. Next up is a team we beat last year, Clemson. What's up, Tigers? You're probably going to go undefeated this year. Yeah, you're trash, but you're probably going to
really,
go undefeated.
Really terrible. What a terrible team.
I'm sure everyone's heard by now. Clemson returns their entire defensive line.
They're all on the All-ACC team. All of them.
The entirety of the All-ACC team is them. Two of their top 3 linebackers are back. They're having the same quote-unquote problems as Alabama now, where the kids who come in the following year have so much garbage time logged that it's like they started for the previous season. So that's encouraging for us. In general, I think the defense is going to look really, really good, potentially the best in the country. They turn over talent at both kicker and punter. They do replace a bunch on the offensive line, an offensive line, though, that people were kind of iffy about here and there last year. I think their run game is really going to control things if Kelly Bryant's under center. Bryant, I think, could make plays, especially with his legs, but was also more of a game manager and someone just kind of stay out of the way while the defense dominated. But I think between him, you know, they have Travis Etienne, they have Tevian Feaster, they have a bunch of run backs back there. Obviously, Hunter Renfro's still there somehow at the wide receiver spot. So I think there's enough talent on the offensive end to keep them scoring points, but I think this defense is definitely gonna win the day for them.
I think the main storyline for Clemson, and it's probably not going to bubble up until they get to the heart of their schedule, is going to be what goes on at the quarterback position. It's very difficult to replace a guy like Kelly Bryant, who took them to the playoff last year. It's very eerie how similar this is to what Alabama is dealing with, like you alluded to, given the fact that those teams have some, you know, pretty deep playoff history at this point. I think the Alabama one's probably sorting itself out a bit quicker. It sounds like Tagovailoa is pretty far ahead.
Right.
Bryant is, by all accounts, playing well. Trevor Lawrence might just be a special player sitting behind him as a true freshman, and he is. I think he's going to take over as a starter at some point during the season, and that's not an easy thing to do. You don't want to lose your team, and that a lot of that's just based on, you know, who really commands who's the commanding presence in the locker room, and Bryant obviously has a big leg up there, but Lawrence, by all accounts, is just such a special talent. And we saw Clemson last year when they finally got to play a superior defense like Alabama, they just didn't quite have it.
Or Syracuse.
Or Syracuse, yes. They just couldn't overcome the Syracuse Orange defense without Kelly Bryant, even. Trevor Lawrence, I think, just adds another element like Tagovailoa does for Alabama. So I don't expect it to be a dramatic college football playoff halftime switch. I do think he will start to eat into those situations earlier than Alabama let happen last year, because Alabama had a couple closer games. I think Clemson should roll through a lot of these games, so they'll get Lawrence a lot of reps, whether or not, and they can probably hide it a little more. But overall, like, I think once they're in the playoffs, I expect them to be in again. I think Lawrence will be the guy. And if he is as good as advertised, and as good as he looked in the spring, and as good as he's reportedly looked during camp, that is very, very scary.
No, I completely agree. We don't have to dive into everything, because I think that the consensus is that this is the most talented team in the conference by a mile. Rather than going game by game, Dan, what is the most likely loss on this regular season schedule?
Let me see. Man, this is tough.
I think it's at Florida State, if only because it's late October, and FSU should have their shit together by then.
Yeah, I think that's probably it. It's probably at Florida State. A&M early in the year is tough. Jimbo knows them, which is not the best. I just don't think A&M's going to have it together by then enough to beat Clemson, which is very, very much a well-oiled machine. At Georgia Tech always brings some weirdness, but I just don't think the LJacks are going to have I just don't think they're going to have the talent. And also, they're the crossover, right? So they play every year.
They are the crossover. To be honest, though, I didn't realize till now, I do like the fact that they faced Georgia Tech the week before us.
I do, too. Didn't we say this about, what team did we say this about last year?
Miami.
And we almost beat Miami. Like, very, very much almost beat Miami. So I do like that, too.
We're still going to lose, but.
Yeah, no, they're going to want to beat us so bad.
Oh,
we have to really enjoy last year's win as long as we can.
I don't give a shit. Even after they beat us this year, I'm still going to talk smack. I mean, think about it. Like, they beat us by more than 50 points the year before, and it didn't stop us from clapping right back the following season and just trolling the hell out of them every day since. So, and just pretend the 50-point loss didn't happen. You know what? Whatever happens this year, I'm going to do the same exact thing.
Yep, keep it moving.
Anyway. All right, so at Florida State is probably the most likely loss, but I think we're both in consensus that Clemson runs the table here.
Yeah, if they have more than one loss, I'll be shocked.
Fair. I'm in the
like, and even one loss, I think there's like, I'd say it's like 50-50, no, 0-1 loss entering the playoff. And even with one loss, unless it's disastrous or just the timing's awful, I don't think that would knock them out. I think the playoff will be open enough this year. We'll let in with one loss without too much of an issue if that was the case.
Yeah, I mean, when you have A&M on there, I think Georgia Tech should be all right, but, you know, South Carolina should be a better team. There's enough on there to... I think most years, yeah, the schedule's there for most ACC teams to get in one loss. I think the over-under is 10.5 for Clemson. I pound the over. So let's move on from Clemson for now. We might have to revisit later on, and we talk a little bit of playoff. Florida State, our favorite for some reason, non-Syracuse ACC team when it comes to football. FSU retools with Willie Taggart at the helm. Some might remember him from his USF days. He was there right after he was at Western Kentucky. Syracuse kind of helped him keep his USF job and somehow launch him here. So when Florida State installs an up-tempo offense and is running us off the field again in the next year or two, you can blame ourselves for that. The USF win over Syracuse ended up turning into the Bulls becoming a competent program again. That landed him at Oregon. Being pretty good at Oregon landed him here. So
that
much
is definitely
fun.
A piece for the week of the Florida State game.
I completely agree. It is. let's hope I'm actually like online for it. I feel like I'm going to be if this kid arrives and they're supposed to.
Oh, that thing. Yeah, right.
Yeah, that whole situation.
That you know. Yeah.
It's going to throw a little bit of a wrench into football season. But happier things in general. But it's I will warn everyone in advance, this is going to be a weird football season.
It's Syracuse. Obviously, it's going to be a weird football season.
Obviously.
No baby's going to impact that one direction or the other.
All right. Moving on from my personal life. Florida State does their usual. They replace a bunch. Their offensive line is still a disaster. It has been for years somehow. They replace most of the defense, though I think Brian Burns is one of the better defenders in the conference. I think that this will be firing where it's supposed to be by the time we hit like mid-October. But I think a lot of people are circling that September 15th game up at Syracuse because they just don't know if Taggart's going to have this team ready to roll just yet. And that could present an opportunity for an upset-minded Babers team that always seems to catch somebody up at the Dome since he arrived.
Yeah, we've talked about it a bunch, like, and other, you know, national publications have brought it up as like a potential big upset spot in the ACC, just because we have that rep of winning that game in the Dome every year. And also, like, Taggart's not just South Florida. Like, it took him a year or two to get Western Kentucky really running, too. He was 2-10 his first year there. Oregon kind of bucked the trend, but he had way more talent to inherit there than he did at USF, which had really bottomed out, or at WKU. And Oregon, you know, probably would have finished a lot better if not the injury to Justin Herbert, which we brought up a couple weeks ago. Yeah, so I think it will take Taggart a little bit, because he is switching from, like, a pretty... It's not that drastic of a shift compared to like what we've seen some other programs, but his system is not the same as Jimbo's. Jimbo is about as close to like the pure pro style offense as you're going to get in college.
Obviously, slow as hell.
It's just slow and beats the hell out of you, and he gets quarterbacks drafted, et cetera, et cetera. Taggart is a little more malleable. He spreads things out a little bit more, but keeps that power running game, which I think is actually a really nice fit for this roster, especially with the running back talent they have. With Cam Akers,
who's going to blow us up again, no matter what happens. That
game. He's a house. It's going to be rough. I do think that is an upset potential spot there. I probably won't pick it, but if there's a huge one on this schedule, like it just lines up for Florida State. Now, if they go in week one and blow the doors off Va Tech, then I'll probably be a lot less eager about that. But also, like, we still don't... I don't know if they're... Do you think their quarterback situation is going to be totally hashed out by week three?
No, but I don't necessarily think it matters, if only because both quarterbacks have started a full season at this point.
Yeah, this is one of the more interesting quarterback battles. It's going under the radar compared to, like, the Alabama one or the Ohio... Well, the Ohio State one's kind of shaken out now. But I talk about the other, like, high-profile ones. Because DeAndre Francois started all of 2016, and then Justin Blackman... Or not Justin,
James Blackman.
Justin Blackman was the Boston College...
Oklahoma State.
Yes, the Oklahoma State wide receiver. Last year. I don't think he's still there, is he?
No, I think he like graduated like a
he
year
graduated
or two
last
ago.
Year.
Was last
yeah,
year
was really
or two
really
years
good.
Ago? Yeah.
I think it was last year. He was on that really good team they had last season. And he's a Jacksonville Jaguar now, as all great Oklahoma State receivers. Oh, no. Justin Blackman was the one a while ago, 2012, and he flamed out. He was a Jaguar. I guess he's still a Jaguar. He's just suspended from the league.
Yeah.
He's out the Josh Norton plan. Who was the Oklahoma State writer? Oh, this is bad. He was like one of the, probably the best receiver in the country.
I feel like that's the case with an OK State receiver every year.
James Washington.
Oh, yeah, him.
Okay, so I mixed up Justin Blackmon, James Washington. It's James Blackmon. His numbers weren't as good as Francois last year were in 2016, but Francois obviously had a much better, more motivated team playing around him. Francois also has, like, he's had a weird offseason. He's had, there was, like, a domestic dispute which has apparently been settled, but that is not what you want from your quarterback. Blackmon, apparently the team, he's very popular with the team. He kind of took ownership of that whole situation last year where Jimbo Fisher clearly didn't. So they're both experienced. They both have a full year under their belts. They both have good moments. Francois is probably a little more, I'd say he's probably a little more gifted, but Blackmon might have earned it more, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I think that's a fair characterization.
It's very, very up in the air. But either one's good enough to beat us, so we'll see. We'll see where that we are when we're at it for that week three. It's still, I could see this one playing into the season because it does seem like about as close as you're gonna get for a quarterback battle.
I would agree. I think we could even see, I think Taggart's smart enough not to do the two quarterback system thing, but it might get some play against Samford just to see what happens, especially as he wants to make sure it's settled, I would assume, by the time we get to the Syracuse game. But speaking of the Syracuse game, I'm looking at the schedule here. I'm seeing wins against Samford, wins against Northern Illinois, at Louisville. I'll give them Wake at home and Florida. So that gets us to 5. I don't think the rest are toss-ups necessarily, but those are just the 5 sure wins I see on the schedule.
Yeah, I think Florida State will be favored in most of these. Va Tech, like we talked about them last week, they should be pretty good again. I think there are some weird question marks they don't usually have. So that's a really telling game for both those teams in week one. And it's a tough opener for a first a new head coach. So we'll see where that goes. At Louisville, we're going to talk about them in a second. That's, you know, it's tough to know what to make of the Cardinals this year. And on the road, that's always, it's never, you know, super easy. Miami is going to be a really tough game. Wake Forest could be a surprisingly tough game, especially. That's like the classic, like, solid verbal letdown look ahead spot between the rivalry game at Miami and then the huge game against Clemson the week after. I guess they have a bye between Miami and Wake, but still. That'll help a little bit, but it's still sandwiched between, it's probably the two biggest games on the schedule for them. And then at Notre Dame's not easy either. Notre Dame also has some question marks, but are very talented. So, yeah, this could be, I could see them winning anywhere from, like, 7 to, like, 9 or 10 if they click early. It's just a matter of, like, there's a lot of very tough toss-ups in here.
Agreed. I'm giving them 9-3 here. I think they lose the obvious ones. At Miami, Clemson, at Notre Dame. And then, like, that does give them some building blocks, though, for next year. So
I think the smart Florida State fan takes a really nice 9-3 year after last year, which had to be so demoralizing. Not that Florida State hasn't had a lot to, like, cheer for recently, but, like, that was one of the most, like, clear, like, coach was just out of it situations since, like, June Jones and SMU. So I think Taggart is, like, the... I think Taggart was a really, really good hire for bouncing back from a situation that had clearly kind of devolved and both sides kind of needed a change. Taggart obviously wants to be there. He's going to be held a recruiting dance for everyone in Florida. And he's very excitable and you know, seems like a player's coach, but like in the ways that still are effective.
I completely agree there. Taggart's a great hire. He's one of the better hires in the country. I just want to see how quickly he gets up off the ground here. I think it'll be quick enough. Moving on to Louisville, Lamar Jackson's gone. That's the biggest takeaway here. They have all their other skill position players for the most part, though. They probably can't run the ball. Most of the line's back, and they replace almost the entire defense and also bring in Brian Van Gorder, which, whatever, man, do your thing. So I don't really see Louisville winning more than... I think Vegas gave them like 8.5, and I just like laughed my ass off on that one. I think this team's like 6-6, 7-5, but, you know, with some of the pieces together to like keep it close and then get better next year.
Yeah. 8.5 is rough. I mean, so to win that bet, you need to only lose 3 games. They have Alabama, they have Florida State, They have an annoying Georgia Tech game.
At Clemson. Good night.
At Clemson. At us, which is not easy, obviously. NC State, which is, you know, pretty even. Wake Forest, which is pretty even. At BC. Like, they're not going to only lose three games.
Even Kentucky. And we're on short rest.
Yeah.
That's actually my upset pick for SU.
That one is probably more likely than
Florida State.
Than Florida State. Florida State's more sexy because we, you know, beat Louisville before and we've played them for a long time.
And Louisville's not going to be a top 25 team we face then.
Probably not. I think the argument for Louisville is that we're all discrediting Bobby Petrino as a very good coach. Bobby Petrino's a very good coach. Like, he had Arkansas as like a borderline national championship contender. He did get Lamar Jackson. No, he didn't get Lamar Jackson. But who recruited Lamar Jackson? Strong? Did he inherit him from Strong and got lucky?
I thought Petrino got him, to be honest.
He might have. Either way, he coached Lamar Jackson the whole time he was there.
So he also found a way to get only 8 wins out of a Lamar Jackson team last year.
Yeah. And that both is like, the defense is really bad, but also Bobby Petrino is the head coach, so it's not his fault.
Do anything to fix it.
Well, hold on. They fired the defensive coordinator.
No, I know, but then
Pete Sermon.
Yeah, but they hired Brian Van Gorder. So like, you didn't do anything
Brian
to fix
Gorder,
it.
Who I'm not directly quoting Bill Donnelly because I don't have this portion of his preview up, but I know it's what he said in essentia. Brian Van Gorder hasn't been part of a defense that improved in a decade, which is an all-time quote. Going down the list, last year Oklahoma State brought him in as like a assistant, like a defensive assistant. I think they fired their DC. The year before, Georgia brought him in as a defensive assistant after he was fired from Notre Dame and like literally like run out of South Bend on like, I think people were chasing him. If Notre Dame fans actually were from South Bend for the most part, like they'd be chasing him out of town. Brian Kelly could not have gotten him out of there fast enough in 2016.
He was part of that amazing first quarter we had against them at MetLife.
He was. He was a Jets coach in 2013. I'm going to click and find out how the New York Jets were in 2013.
Jets.
I'm assuming because I can't imagine. Like, I'm trying to think of that like general time frame. I can't imagine they were good.
Nope. I don't think they've been like any.
Well, they were 8-8. They were 8-8, but Rex Ryan was there, so the defense like is Rex Ryan's baby.
That's a typical Jets season, though.
Yeah, he was at Auburn.
The worst 8-8 team ever.
He was in Auburn in 2012, which is the year after Cam Newton, right? And
yes.
They were not very. They were 3-9, and winless in the SEC. That was 2 years after Cam Newton. The year after they fell to like 8-5 or so, and then they went 3-9 and fired Gene Chizik. Yeah, so he was on that staff. He was the head coach at Georgia Southern. He was, and that didn't go well. It only lasted a year. I believe he tried to go away from the option, and that is a big no-no there. So I guess, like, he was on the staff of the 05 Jacksonville Jaguars. I'm going to assume that wasn't a good football team based on the history of the franchise.
Actually, I think that might have been a good football team.
Was that one of the weird playoff teams?
I know
07. Oh, they were 12-4.
Yeah, that was actually one of the better Jacksonville Jaguars teams.
Okay, so we found one. And he was a mid-year assistant at 2016 Georgia, which was the first Kirby Smart Georgia team, which I don't think he had a huge impact on how that team did.
No.
Yeah, so basically, it has not been a good run for Brian Van Gorder. He's a pretty bad defensive coordinator. He has worse hair. And it's just like a really funny hire to make.
Because there's nobody on this defense really. Like, there's a couple people on this defense we're talking about, but I'm not going to because Brian Van Gorder is going to ruin them.
I took notes. Well, Jaire Alexander was basically the only thing that kept their defense afloat last year. He had a ton of interceptions. He was a big-time playmaker at corner. And he is in the NFL. He plays for my Green Bay Packers, so I look forward to that. When he was off the field, according to Bill C., they were really bad the whole time. When he was off the field, they were, like, special bad.
Well, he was a great cover guy. So, yeah, I don't see this going well for them. I'm gonna put that upset pick in pen, to be honest, right now.
I will on offense, like, though, Petrino, I could see them being, like, a worse version of last year where they still score a lot of points. They do have a quarterback named Pass, which is cool.
Yeah, and he doesn't run much.
He's a pocket passer. His name is Pass.
Appropriate. We've had this discussion here before.
And he's a former four-star guy, and he was a big recruit. I think they got him over Alabama, if I remember. I remember when he was a recruit. I could be wrong on that, but I don't feel like looking it up. But Juwan Pass might be pretty good, but he hasn't played yet. I mean, he's played lightly. So that's a question mark. Their offense, like, I think otherwise projects to be pretty good. The defense just might be really abysmal, like worse than last year, which is not great. But Pastrino's been a good head coach and is like the weird like model of consistency at Louisville right now. So I don't even know, like, they have a new administration. I don't know if they'd want to overhaul the football program right now based on everything else that's going on there, or if they'd use it as an excuse just to like get their own person in.
Yeah, I think he's going to go at some point, and if they finish less than 7-5 this year, it might be their excuse. But yeah, looking at the schedule, I got losses to Alabama, Florida State, at Clemson, at Syracuse. That's four. And give me at BC, and I think they can probably beat the rest. So even then, that's still 7-5.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely not beating Alabama. That's going to be an ugly, ugly week one game. I think Florida State, I mean, at worst, Florida State should be able to get enough done on offense to take care of them. I won't like go out of my way to pick us in that game, but it could happen. I'm definitely picking Clemson. Those are three pretty comfortable losses, I feel like, to get to your 8.5. And then one more, I mean, give me any of... they're not going to go undefeated against Georgia Tech at BC, at Syracuse, Wake Forest, and NC State and Kentucky. Like, they're going to lose at least one, probably two of those. So, yeah, I say they're probably looking like a 6-6, 7-5 season, in all likelihood.
And that's fine for them. Or it should be.
It should be. Now, we'll find out if it is. It's really tough to gauge, like, what the scenario at Louisville football is, and whether it's impacted at all by Louisville basketball. It's probably not fair for it to be, but... It's hard to, I mean, we know these things like impact, like we know how the seasons tend to bleed into each other and how like overall feel at the university within the fan base like is a thing. Obviously, we are also a two-sport school, so it will be interesting to see how that plays out. Like, I don't think Pastrino, as far as we know, hasn't done anything to deserve getting fired aside from whatever happens this season, but it wouldn't be the craziest thing if a season goes really poorly or even like moderately poorly by Louisville standards. If the new administration just wants a clean slate all over the place.
Yeah, I buy it. Moving on from Louisville, one team that might be a little overrated, to another team that might be a little overrated, NC State. NC State's been recruiting really well, and I will say that right off the jump. I would say that last year's team was definitely a breakthrough for Dave Dorn. Winning 9 games is no easy feat anywhere. If you're not a blue blood, it's especially not an easy feat at NC State, which doesn't do it very often. But, like... Wolfpack now made a bowl game in 4 straight seasons. Ryan Finley is probably the best quarterback in the conference. They have a lot of great playmakers, wide receiver. But at the same time, they return hardly anybody on defense. And I think people are underrating just how much that front four in particular played a part in this group's success. So to be honest, like I could see, and other people are seeing this too, like this seems like a half step back year, and only that they win maybe 6 games, and don't necessarily, you know, start looking at that third place, fourth place finish this year. But it doesn't mean they can't get right back to it in a year or so.
Yeah, it could be tough because when you have a quarterback like Ryan Finley entering his senior year, who has so much experience and got pretty good heights last year, you want to compete for something more there. But they lose Jalen Samuels, they lose Nyheim Hines. Their defense should take a step back just based on like losing Bradley Chubb, which is a big deal, and a handful of other big players. Their offensive line, I think, loses a pair of all-ACC types. So just like there should be a natural regression here unless like they get a lot of production from players who haven't really done it before. I think Doran's an interesting place. He was one of the like many, many coaches brought up for the Tennessee job. I feel like that would have even been an underwhelming hire for them. Not that they didn't make one. But I feel like Doran is in a spot where like he seems like a really, really solid coach for NC State. He just seems like if he a school even like one tier higher went to hire him away, everyone would be like, oh, that's just like what, like very meh.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Tennessee fans would have been much happier hiring him than anybody else, especially who they ended up with in Jeremy Pruitt. Yeah, I think Finley's going to put up big numbers. But again, I don't necessarily think this team's running game is as good. And that defense, like, that defense looked really good in a lot of spurts, but you don't just replace that sort of pass rushing talent. Like, they were still giving up 25 points a game. They still struggled against the pass. So there's a lot of reasons to cast at least a little bit of doubt on this Wolfpack team. If I'm looking at the schedule here, I got Sherwin's against JMU, Georgia State at Marshall, probably Virginia, and maybe at North Carolina. But that stretch from October 6th through the October 6th game against Boston College to the November 17th game at Louisville, I'd be surprised if they're able to eke out something better than 3-3 there at most.
We're sitting in a really nice letdown look ahead again. They stuck a road game at Syracuse right between a road game at Clemson and a home game against Florida State.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's really ideal, and I don't think this is going to be a – if we beat them at home, it's not going to be a major, major upset.
No.
But it actually might end up being – if we were able to beat them, I think it'd be a better upset than the Louisville game could be by end of season. Yeah, I think we probably win this game, but I don't want to necessarily commit to that just yet, because I know there's a lot of those kind of like iffy games in the middle of the schedule for Syracuse.
Basically, everyone sub Florida State in the Atlantic is like in the same general tier of team, and you just hope that you win like two of them.
Oh, 100%. Syracuse has won like none of them of late, so.
Yeah, we've really come up short in these, like, coin flips. And if we, want to take the step forward to, like, being a bowl team, you have to win some of these. Like, even that Schaefer team in the first year of the ACC, like, they won some of them.
Yeah.
They got the things done. So that's what we need to start doing, hopefully in a more aesthetically pleasing fashion than we did that year. I think we threw for, like, 10 yards and NC State still won on the road there. But I would take that. So... yeah, that's definitely a thing we need to, that's the major next step here in the development of this program.
Right, and like NC State's in the same boat as us, and so is Wake. Like that adage I've used for the last few years of like, Syracuse every year is going to win four, lose four, and it's what you do in the middle that kind of defines the season. I'd say NC State's kind of in a similar boat more often than not. So this year, like looking at what those four wins are, I think I named them. Lucky them, I'd say there's only like three shore losses on here right now with at Clemson, Florida State, and I'd say probably Boston College. And I know that like has me now like buying into Boston College. Actually, no, I'd say West Virginia is the more shore loss than that.
And even that's not a shore loss. I mean, it's at home. Like, they could win that game. I think West Virginia is probably better than them, but I'm not going to guarantee it.
I'm going to bank on West Virginia there. I think West Virginia's starters are especially on the offensive end, are going to be able to blow by this defense early. But yeah, I'd say NC State, I think they could go 6-6, 7-5 here. I think 7 wins is fair. Really depends on like how you feel about Louisville, North Carolina, and Wake Forest. Like, give me 7-5. No, actually, give me 6-6. Sorry, I know it's a little bit of a cop-out. Give me 6-6, but there's enough pieces there with a younger talent that you see how they bounce back the following season.
Yeah, I think they're, like, right in the cusp of that 6-7 wins. I think just, like, this whole Atlantic is so – there's a lot of that. And it's just going to be – it's just a matter of piecing together some of those and just finding ways to win some of these games that's been, like, the real differentiating factor. And last year, NC State finished 9-3, and that was – or I think 9-4 with the bowl. Is that what they ended up?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, like, last year they also benefited from Florida State having their worst season in forever. Yeah, so I think they're right in that 6-7 win range. And, if Finley takes a huge step forward for his final year and is, like, one of the 10 best quarterbacks in college football, then maybe they're looking at, 8 wins and another, like, nice year. I don't see their ceiling being much higher than that, though.
I would agree. Moving on to yet another team that's in that kind of, to steal a term from Podcast Ain't Played Nobody, the cul-de-sac of sorts here in the ACC, Wake Forest and the Clawfence. Everyone's kind of banking on them, continuing their upward trajectory. I think they can, but I also think that expecting them to be the same as they were last year or even better is also kind of a fool's errand. There's no more John Wolford. Wolford was a really dynamic quarterback by his senior year. Cam Serene's gone. Jesse Bates heads off to the NFL. Duke Ejiofor is also gone, their top pass rusher. They lose about half their defense. They don't lose much on offense, and Greg Dortch is back, and he wasn't even playing in that game against Syracuse last year. But in general, I don't necessarily think that Hinton's going to be able to replicate the type of production that Wolford had. So it honestly depends on how much you believe that this run game led by Matt Colburn, and suddenly Wake is a run game again. Like, it really depends on how much you think that's going to be able to carry the load on offense. I think they're another team that probably is without going game by game, is probably in that 6-7 win range, if only because of what they're replacing. But like everybody else, they're really not too far from falling under that 6-win mark, just because of the parity in the middle there.
Yeah, I think for Wake this year, you're probably looking at like a step to a half step back, and you just have to hope that that means they can still get to a bowl game and reap the benefits there. They definitely, I think it's fair to say that Clawson has followed through and gotten them to a new level of from, you know, where they were. I think the rebuild is basically done, and now this is the sustaining portion. And, you know, just going 6-6 and making it to a bowl, whatever happens there, is, like, probably a pretty good result based on where they were coming from and the level of talent that you can get at Wake Forest. They do have the obstacle. They have Hinton, while I don't think he'll be Walford, he was pretty effective in some time in 2016 when Walford was hurt. But he's out for the first three games of the season. It's not the most difficult three-game stretch. They do have Boston College on September 13th. Luckily at home for them, but they do travel to Tulane in week one. That could be a weird game. They play the option. They're not a team that plays Georgia Tech all the time. That could be a weird one at Yeoman Stadium on the road. I think Wake will win it, but without your quarterback, that's not the easiest spot. I mean, it could be more difficult at least. And then they're thrown into, they have Rice as their final non-conference. Which is pretty, I think you'll take that all the time, especially Rice in a coaching change year. That's not the final non-conference. Notre Dame, technically, is September 22nd. That's going to be a rough one, although they do host them, so that should be interesting. And then it's off to the races. They have Clemson, a bye, at Florida State, at Louisville, which is a tough stretch, and then us, and then at NC State. They do get Pitt this year, and then at Duke. So I think starting strong and finishing strong is going to be very important.
How do they get this five games in a row at home nonsense?
I don't know. It's weird. It's five in a row without a bye either.
Yeah, that's silly.
And then they never play more than two on the road in a row.
Somehow.
I mean, we do know that Wake Forest is the like consigliere for the ACC, so they clearly got the beneficial the beneficial hookup here.
All right, looking at this schedule, I got a win against Tulane, though I really think Tulane could take the win there. I got a win over Tulane, a win over Towson, a win over Rice. Give me the Pitt game. That's four. And then I think
Duke's tough, but Duke's not exactly a great home field.
Yeah, but I think Duke is good enough. I think give me four definites, and then I'll give them definite losses against Florida State, Clemson, and Notre Dame.
And they're going to definitely lose one of Louisville and NC State. They're not going to sweep those two on the road. Right. So I think you can probably pencil in one more loss between those two.
And they're probably going to lose one of the BC or Syracuse games too, to be honest.
Yeah, it's just, I think they're like a 5-7 win. And you hope, if you're awake, if you get 6 wins, I think you're very happy, because that means you withstood losing all the players from the last administration, which I know is not always like a huge concern when the last administration obviously didn't succeed, but we've seen plenty of coaches come in, win right off the bat, and it like then fall apart. This is all Clawson now moving forward, and you obviously survive a pretty big quarterback change.
Yeah, if I'm Wake, I'm fine with it. I think there's a lot of Wake fans who think that kind of 9 wins is, I've seen Wake fans claiming 9 wins is like something that they want this year, and that's not happening.
I think I would go as far to say that I don't know what would. I don't think Clawson could get fired this year. I think he has gotten enough goodwill now where he could. I can't even imagine what would have to happen in terms of purely on the field stuff for him to lose his job.
Same.
Yeah, I mean, even a disastrous 3-win year, I think he has enough. He has enough goodwill to survive it, because that would probably entail like a lot of bad injuries and whatnot.
Would agree. I think, you know, Wake succeeding, even though they're North Carolina, I think it's a good sign for Syracuse's ability to succeed. So I want us to beat them. Otherwise, I don't really care what happens to Deacons. I know they recently like broke their, in the last 2 years, they broke their string of bad luck against us. I hope that bad luck continues this year, this time maybe without injuries for them.
Yeah, I don't, I obviously don't have any, you know, contempt for Wake Forest. I think, like you said, I think it's a good sign when they succeeded. It, like, their situation is not significantly easier than ours. So it's, anytime a team that's a very much a peer school of Syracuse succeeds, I think it's a fair, it's fair to, like, look on that as a bright spot for the potential for Syracuse.
Totally.
And they definitely got there. They definitely got there last year. I mean, that bowl win was awesome for them, even though they beat A&M, right?
They beat A&M, and I think it was 55-52 was the final?
Yeah, and then that's a crazy game, and that's a very much like a bowl result, and A&M had, you know, I think they had already fired someone at that point. So that's like, you know, it's a weird situation, but, you know, anytime you're a Wake Forest and you beat, you know, a Texas A&M in a bowl, like, that's got to feel pretty good.
Yeah. All right, so we said Clemson's going to win this division. Do you think Clemson wins the conference? And if so, are we assuming Clemson also makes the playoff?
Yes, yes, yes.
Fair enough. All right, I think that's it for our Atlantic Division preview. Like we said, next week we're going to have Syracuse in full. Going to go down the entire roster, the entire schedule, talk just about everything you could possibly say about the Orange. Dan, anything else for you before we depart?
No, hope to see some of you guys tomorrow night at Broken Bow. / I hope I saw some of you guys last night at Broken Bow, depending on when this podcast goes up.
Yes, please go, folks, please. Anyway, that was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, everybody, for tuning into Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. You can rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, on wherever else you listen to podcasts, and go Orange.
Go Orange.